Where? Speransky said. At his building. Damn. If he's holed up again, he could be in there for weeks. No. He's leaving this afternoon. Going back to the airport. In his own car. Because he's taking something with him. This is via the doorman. Correct. The poor sap thinks he's helping to keep Rutherford safe. Where's the drifter? Unknown. Where's Rutherford's car? In the building's garage. We have the make, model, and license plate. I know the garage for that building. It's underground. Enclosed. I don't like it. Ambush? That's what I'm thinking. Struck me that way, too. Tell the team to be extra careful. We can't afford another spectacle. Reacher sat in the doorman's chair for 40 minutes. Then his eye was drawn to the monitor, to the rectangle at the top left, the one fed by the camera above the garage door. The image was slightly fisheyed to give a wide field of view, but a black Suburban was still an unmistakable vehicle. It pulled to the side of the street, 10 yards short of the entrance, close enough for Reacher to make out the blonde splashes of the driver's and the passenger's hair. A blue Toyota passed it and pulled up in front of the garage. A mark in the demerit column, Reacher thought. Time had no doubt been tight, but they still should have replaced their vehicles. Reacher watched as a woman got out of the Toyota's rear seat. It was the red-haired woman from the alleyway the day before. Reacher saw her work the keypad. 1, 2, 3, 4. The same code ever since Rutherford moved there. The car pulled forward and the woman got back in. It momentarily disappeared, then showed up on the next segment of the screen, emerging from the bottom of the ramp and swinging into the middle of 3 vacant spaces in the central bank. The driver got out. It was the woman he'd seen behind the wheel the day before. The second woman joined her. Then the guy Reacher had knocked out. Then the one he'd thrown through the window. The 4 fanned out through the space. They checked both regular entrances and looked for alternative ways in or out. Then they located Rutherford's car, an off-white 1970s VW Bug, parked more or less at the center of the left-hand wall. There was an empty space on each side of it. Beyond that, to the left, was a Jeep Grand Cherokee. To the right, a Ford F-150. A good setup from an ambusher's point of view. Both were tall vehicles. They offered plenty of concealment. The guy Reacher had knocked out pointed to each of them in turn, then to another empty space perpendicular against the far wall. Reacher could tell what the guy was thinking. The plan practically made itself. The driver could tuck the Toyota into the space by the far wall. One guy could hide behind the Jeep. One could hide behind the Ford. The other woman could conceal herself near the pedestrian door in case Rutherford got spooked and tried to run back into the building. Otherwise, they would wait for him to reach his car. Then the Toyota would pull forward, in electric mode, like yesterday, so there'd be no sound, no warning. The 2 guys would emerge. One would open the door. The other would grab Rutherford and push him inside. A piece of cake. The garage was a good setup in a broader sense, too. It was a known location. There was no uncertainty over which route Rutherford might take if they tried to tail him to the airport. No concerns over traffic or parking. A lower chance of any passers-by becoming involved than if they mounted an operation on the street. And no need to worry about the security cameras, as they had an ally covering the monitoring station. Or so they believed. The garage was a good setup. But it wasn't perfect. The chance of members of the public entering the scene was reduced, but not eliminated. That left the possibility of witnesses, and of collateral damage. Too high a possibility in Reacher's judgment. But he wasn't planning the ambush. The ones who were remained huddled for a minute, pointing, waving their arms, arguing. Reacher would have liked the image to be bigger, but from what he could make out, the guy he had knocked out was at odds with the driver. The other 2 had eased back, staying out of the argument. Finally, the driver shook her head and pointed toward Rutherford's Bug. She put her hands on her hips and waited until the knocked-out guy returned to the Toyota. He opened its trunk, took something out, and carried it to the VW, around to its rear. He knelt down and stuck 1 hand beneath the car. Reacher's first thought was bomb. Then he reconsidered. The box was too small to hold much explosive. It had to be something else. The guy gave up on the underneath and slipped the device into the hollow in the center of the bug's chunky rear fender. The driver pulled out her phone. She checked the screen and nodded. A tracker, Reacher realized. A smart tactic. A mark in the merit column. Reacher watched the Toyota leave the garage, then turned his attention to the Suburban. It was 50-50 in his mind whether it was there as backup, in which case it would leave, or if it would wait and tail Rutherford anyway in case there was a problem with the tracker. 10 minutes passed. There was no sign of movement. Reacher had conceived the exercise as a way to observe his enemies in action, to gauge their competence and decision-making. Now their caution offered him another opportunity, the chance to shake things up a little. A sign that read, "Back in 5 minutes," was peeping out of the heap of clutter next to the monitor. Reacher fished it out, set it on the countertop, then picked up his bag and headed for the main door. He walked down the street, past Marty's car, took the alley Rutherford had cut through, and turned to approach the Suburban head-on. He was 30 yards away when the guys inside it spotted him. The driver was the first to notice. He nudged the passenger in the ribs. Reacher saw them both stiffen. He kept on walking, slow and easy, arms loose and well away from his sides. He didn't want any misunderstandings. He drew level with the passenger window, then stopped and pulled what he hoped was a friendly, non-threatening smile. The passenger looked at him for a long second, then lowered the window. "What do you want?" the guy said. "First, I want to apologize for yesterday," Reacher said. "I stumbled into something I didn't understand. I had no idea what was going on and just acted on instinct. I hope your buddies are okay. Anyway, since then I had a long talk with a very interesting guy. He set me straight on a few things, like what I need to do if I want to leave this town in one piece. So here's the deal. I know where Rutherford is, and I'm willing to hand him to you on a plate. But you'll have to move fast. There's not much time. He set up his doorman to pass on a story about him driving to the airport, but the truth is, he's got a guy lined up to smuggle him out of the country. A private plane, false papers, disguises, the whole 9 yards. Meet me in the coffee shop in 5 minutes and I'll explain everything. Just don't be late. This is a one-time thing. Dawdle and he'll slip through your fingers for good. Only it won't be my fault this time." Reacher strolled to the next cross street, and as soon as he was out of sight of the Suburban, he broke into a run. He looped around toward the main entrance to Rutherford's building and then ducked back into the alley. He eased the pair of dumpsters apart and settled into the gap he had created to wait. He figured the Suburban guys wouldn't tell anyone what they'd heard right away. It was too crazy. They'd want to debate it between themselves first, for at least a minute. They probably wouldn't believe what Reacher had said. But could they afford to ignore it? Probably not. They'd decide they had to follow up. But they'd have to report in first, to whoever was pulling their strings. Then it would be crunch time. If Reacher had oversold the story, they might abandon the garage, drive around and park near the coffee shop. He hoped he hadn't been that convincing. In which case, a more sensible response would be for the guys to split up. For one of them to stay on station in the Suburban on the grounds that Reacher's tail was most likely a ploy, and for the second guy to head for the coffee shop on foot just in case Reacher was telling the truth. Time would be tight after all the deliberations. Getting there before the deadline would be tough, so the second guy would take the quickest possible route, which would be the shortest, which would be through the alley. The clock in Reacher's head showed 4 minutes since he had walked away from the Suburban. No one entered the alley. 4.5 minutes. No one entered. 4.75. Then Reacher heard footsteps. Someone running. Light, efficient, purposeful. Coming his way. Reacher waited a beat, then stepped out from between the dumpsters. The passenger from the Suburban was in the alley, 10 feet away. He stopped himself after another step and dropped into the same kind of weird stance he'd used the day before. Then he had a change of heart. Maybe it was the size difference. Maybe it was the expression on Reacher's face. Maybe it was the recollection of what had happened to his two comrades. But whatever the reason, he straightened up, reached behind his back, and produced a gun. A Beretta M9. You're not going to give Rutherford up, are you? He said. I might, Reacher said, on one condition. Which is? Tell me why you're after him. The guy paused. He has something we want. No shit, Sherlock, Reacher said. Be more specific. I don't think so. And I don't need to. Because very soon you'll be begging to tell us where Rutherford is. Us, Reacher said. Who's us? All will be revealed when the time is right. The guy made a rotating motion with the gun. Now turn around. Hands on the wall, feet wide apart. I'm sure you're familiar with the routine. The guy was standing 7 feet away. Reacher was out of his range. But Reacher was almost a foot taller than him. You win, Reacher said. He began to turn, moving clockwise, pivoting on his right foot, bringing his left foot closer to the guy with the gun, halving the distance between them. He kept rotating until his left shoulder was facing the guy. Then he planted his foot, shot out his hand, and grabbed the underside of the barrel. He twisted the gun viciously away from his body, breaking the guy's finger with the trigger guard and messing up the ligaments in his wrist. The guy howled and pulled back. The Beretta clattered to the ground. He glanced down at his hand. Blood was starting to flow from a break in the skin above his knuckle. He sucked the wound. Then he returned his focus to Reacher. He took half a step back and feinted a kick to the body with his front foot, but instead of following through, he used the momentum to rise on his toes and swing a punch around toward Reacher's temple. Reacher leaned back and deflected the blow with his forearm. The force of the block spun the guy around, leaving his left side exposed. Reacher jabbed him in the kidney. He shaped up for a kick, but dialed it back at the last moment and more or less pushed the guy's hip with his foot. The guy staggered back and sideways, and his legs tangled, and he tripped himself, landing in a heap at the base of the far wall. Reacher stepped closer and waited for the guy to make eye contact. What does Rutherford have that you want? The guy pulled himself onto all fours, then slowly hauled himself to his feet and stood there for a moment, hunched and sagging, like a man thoroughly defeated. Then he exploded forward and threw two quick, sharp jabs to try to push Reacher back. He threw two more, then spun around, whipping up his right foot and aiming for the side of Reacher's head. It would have been a problem if the kick had landed. It may not have had the weight behind it to knock Reacher out, but it could have slowed him down, disoriented him, given the guy a way back into the fight. Only Reacher didn't back off. He did what he always did, moved closer to the danger. He saw the guy's body begin to twist, so stepped in and met his foot when it was only at waist height. He trapped the guy's shin between his arm and his body and slid his hand back to grab the ankle. Then he lifted the guy's foot, leaving him hopping back and forth, fighting for balance with an expression of pure outrage on his face. You should save moves like that for gym class, Reacher said, where there are rules. Out here there are only decisions and consequences. Well, one decision. And you have to make it. Whether to tell me what I want to know. If you decide not to, you'll never walk again. Not without a limp. The guy didn't respond. Take a moment to think, Reacher said. Have you ever seen an X-ray of a knee? It's not the bones you need to worry about. They heal up easily. It's all the other parts you need to keep in mind. Ligaments, tendons, cartilage. But mainly ligaments. If they get damaged, not too severely, and you're a famous sports player with limitless money and immediate access to a hospital, there's a chance of a decent repair. Only you're not a top sports guy. I'm guessing you don't have limitless money, and I can assure you that if my foot crashes down on your knee with all my weight behind it, the damage is going to be way beyond severe. That's for damn sure. The guy heaved back, trying to free his foot. He flailed with his left hand, trying to land a blow or gouge Reacher's eyes, but he was stymied by his own locked leg. Okay, he said, panting, when he finally gave up. Fine. Do what you have to do. I'm not saying a word. Reacher didn't move. Come on. What are you waiting for? Just do it. This is your last chance, Reacher said. What does Rutherford have that you want? It doesn't matter what you do to me. I'll never tell you anything. If that's the way you want it, Reacher said. He lifted his right foot, held it still, and looked the guy in the eyes. then stamped down hard toward the knee of the guy's standing leg. The guy threw his head back and closed his eyes and whimpered, but he didn't say a word. Reacher's shoe was solid and heavy. He stopped his foot with the sole an inch from the guy's knee. He paused, then lowered his foot to the ground. He released the guy's leg and simultaneously punched him just below the ear. The guy went down sideways, his right leg still extended like he'd just kicked a ball, and didn't move again. Reacher checked that the guy was breathing, then retrieved his weapon. It was well-maintained and, unlike Marty's, loaded. Reacher searched the guy's clothes. He had a wallet with some cash, which Reacher took as spoils of war. But no credit cards or ID or anything indicating a name or an address, or any kind of temporary accommodations. He had no spare ammunition, and nothing else in his pockets except for a phone. Reacher pressed the button below its screen and a message appeared saying that his print wasn't recognized, so to try again or enter a key code. He held the button against the unconscious guy's thumb and the screen lit up. Reacher touched a picture of a phone and a list of calls appeared. There was nothing since yesterday. There were no voicemails, no text messages, and the picture of an address book only revealed 5 entries. All were numbers, no names. Reacher put the phone in his pocket, slipped the gun into his waistband, and fetched his bag from the gap between the dumpsters. He took out the duct tape, fastened the guy's ankles together, taped his hands behind his back, stuck a strip over his mouth, then hoisted the guy over his shoulder and heaved him into one of the dumpsters. Chapter 13. The Suburban was still parked in the same spot when Reacher stepped out of the alley. He waved with both arms to attract the driver's attention, then gestured for the guy to join him. The driver shook his head and indicated that Reacher should come to him. Reacher threw up his hands as if exasperated and hurried along the sidewalk until he was level with the passenger door. The window whirred down and Reacher could see that the driver was holding a gun. Another Beretta. Presumably also well-maintained. Presumably also loaded. He had it in his left hand, low down in his lap, pointing sideways. Not an ideal firing position. But that was compensated for by the size of the target he had to aim at. Reacher's chest. "Come quick," Reacher said, ignoring the gun. "To the alley. Your friend needs help. Bring the car." "What are you talking about?" the driver said. "I waited for you at the coffee shop, and when you didn't show, I came back to look for you. I figured I'd cut through the alley to save time, and I found your friend. He was on the ground, in bad shape. He was bleeding. He had this big cut on his forehead. He was unconscious, breathing, but only just. He must have gotten mugged. He had no wallet, no phone. Did you call 911? "I couldn't. I don't have a phone. That's why I came to get you. And I figured that with this whole computer situation going on, it would be quicker for you to drive him to the hospital anyway." The driver paused, then put down the gun. "All right. Show me. Come on, follow me. Pull into the alley, then you'll see him." Reacher set off at a fast jog, and after a second, he heard an engine fire up behind him. Tires squealed, and a moment later, the Suburban shot past him. It continued to accelerate, then darted into the mouth of the alley without signaling. Reacher caught up and squeezed along the passenger side. The driver climbed out, his gun in his hand, and joined Reacher at the front of the vehicle. "Where is he?" the driver said. "I don't see him." "I forgot," Reacher said. "I put him in the dumpster, the far one, to keep him safe. I didn't know if you'd still be waiting, or how long it would take to find you." The driver raised his gun to Reacher's chest. "You forgot?" "What?" Reacher said. "You never forgot anything?" "All right." The driver raised the gun to Reacher's head. "Back up against the wall. Keep your hands where I can see them." He waited for Reacher to comply, then moved forward to the dumpster. "Don't move." He lifted the lid with his free hand and took a glance inside. Reacher waited a moment for him to register the state his buddy was in, then strode forward and pulled the gun from his waistband. He switched it around so he was holding it by the barrel and swung it in a fast sideways arc. The butt smashed into the driver's elbow. He screamed, dropped his own gun and the lid of the dumpster, and slumped down on one knee. Reacher switched the gun to his left hand, wrapped his right hand around the side of the driver's head, and slammed it against the dumpster. He grabbed the front of the driver's shirt, half-lifted him, then dropped him down in a sitting position with his back against the metal. His body was as slack as a rag doll. Reacher waited a moment to make sure the guy was conscious, then rammed his gun into the guy's mouth. "I'm going to ask you a question," Reacher said. "I'll give you 5 seconds to think about it, then I'll remove the gun. If you give me the correct answer, I'll let you fish your buddy out of the trash and drive away. Give me anything other than the correct answer, and I'll put the gun back in your mouth and blow the back of your skull clean off. Are we clear?" The driver's eyes widened, and he did his best to nod his head. "What does Rutherford have that you want?" Reacher raised his thumb and each finger on his right hand in turn at 1 second intervals. Then he pulled out the gun. "Go ahead." The driver raised his chin. "Shoot me. Don't waste any more time. There's nothing you can say or do that'll make me tell you what it is." "You'd rather give up your life than one little piece of information," Reacher said. "That seems like a poor choice." "It's not just my life. I have a wife, a brother. I know what would happen to them. Come on." He opened his mouth, leaned forward, and gripped the muzzle with his teeth. "Do it!" Reacher pulled the gun away and clubbed the driver on the side of the head with his right hand, knocking him out cold. He retrieved the dropped gun, checked it, tucked both weapons into his waistband, then started to go through the guy's pockets. The contents proved no more satisfying than the passengers. He had no credit cards, nothing with a name or an address, no spare ammunition. His phone had been used more recently, but it contained no names or personal information. Reacher took the cash as before, duct-taped his ankles, wrists, and mouth, and dropped him in the other dumpster. Then he turned to the Suburban. He checked the glove box, the sun visors, the door pockets, under the seats, under the floor mats, in the trunk, around the spare and the jack and the little wallet of tools, under the hood, in the wheel arches, and found nothing. Not even a loose dime or a discarded candy wrapper. Whoever these guys were, they were fastidious. That was for damn sure. Reacher closed the hood and the tailgate and all the doors apart from the driver's. He was tempted to climb in, take the vehicle, partly because it could be useful, and partly to deprive the enemy of a valuable asset. But he had seen one of the same crew stick a tracking device on Rutherford's bug. That meant there was a risk they'd use the same technology on their own vehicles. So he made sure the key was in the ignition and left the Suburban to take its chances. Someone had left a stack of cards advertising a pizza delivery service on the reception counter, but otherwise the lobby of Rutherford's building seemed undisturbed when Reacher returned. He was starting to feel hungry again, so he tucked a card into his back pocket, then approached the closet door. He braced himself in case the doorman had used the time to think, to see through the ruse. Then he worked the lock and found the guy sitting on the floor with his knees up near his shoulders. He blinked his tiny eyes against the sudden light, then recognized Reacher and tried to speak, but his voice was unintelligible through the shiny tape. "Good news," Reacher said. He grabbed the doorman's hands and heaved him to his feet, then took out his smaller knife and started to cut him free. "False alarm. There's no threat against Mr. Rutherford. Not today. He's perfectly safe. For now. Although he's not feeling very well, he just called. He's postponed his trip again. He's going to stay in his apartment for a few days until he's feeling better. He doesn't want any visitors or any other interruptions at all. I'm just going to go up and check if he needs anything, then I'll be heading back to Nashville. It was a pleasure meeting you. Keep up the good work." Reacher figured that if Rutherford's neighbor could spend half the year away on cruises, he must be an older guy, retired, with plenty of time on his hands, and many years of accumulating junk behind him. Reacher pictured an apartment crammed with chintzy furniture, flowery curtains, pictures of children, probably grandchildren. But when Rutherford opened the door and stepped back, Reacher saw a large, almost empty space. All the dividing walls had been removed. The exterior walls had been painted bright white. The floor was covered with pale gray concrete that was sealed and polished to match the kitchen countertops. Aluminum blinds, angled to allow the afternoon sun to flood in, covered the windows. The coffee table had a lozenge-shaped glass top with a curved wood support rather than regular legs. The rest of the furniture was all chrome and black leather. Reacher had seen pictures of things like it in a magazine about mid-century designers. There were polished walnut units with doors set into them separating the far third of the room. A thing that looked like a giant metal egg made out of riveted panels sat on a black wood tripod, and a set of blonde wood shelves. Each one was an apparently random length, but Reacher figured they were probably carefully calculated to create some kind of effect. They seemed to be floating near the wall rather than being attached with brackets or supports, and they held a sparse selection of random objects, the kind that were no doubt pronounced objets by the people who sold them. "What do you think?" Rutherford said. "I don't know," Reacher said. "Is it a home? Or a showroom?" "A home. It's been Mitch's for years, although he does have a couple of other ones now. And it hasn't always looked like this. He had it completely remodeled last year. He has some really cool things now. See this?" Rutherford pointed at the egg. "It came from a light bulb factory in Germany. They used it to test the vacuum seal inside the glass bulbs. Now Mitch uses it for storing his whiskey." Rutherford walked across and opened a door set into the front of the thing. Inside were four crystal decanters full of golden liquid and eight stubby glasses. "Think twice before helping yourself, though. The cheapest kind costs $20,000 a bottle." "I'll stick to coffee," Reacher said, "assuming your friend has anything so pedestrian." "Me too," Rutherford said. He crossed to the kitchen area and opened a wall cupboard containing a vast, shiny machine bristling with knobs and gauges and levers. "If I can figure out how this thing works." Reacher moved to the center of the room. "I thought you said you had the keys so you could water your friend's plants."
"Right."
Rutherford nodded. "What happened?"
"Did you forget? Have they died?"
"No, of course not. Mitch would kill me. They're over there on the shelf. Good as new." Rutherford pointed to a row of three miniature pots on the shelf to the left of the living area window. Each one contained a shriveled stalk, like the trunk of a tiny decaying tree.
"Those things are alive?" Reacher said.
"The outer pair are over 100 years old. The other one is younger." Mitch said, "It's about 60, I think. They come from a forest in the foothills of Mount Fuji, Japan. It's the only place in the world they grow. The same family has tended to them for generations."
"Your friend has interesting taste. What does he do?"
"He's in IT, like me."
Rutherford paused, and a look of genuine sadness settled over his face. Only his million-dollar idea actually worked, unlike the piece of trash I pinned my hopes on.
Reacher took a seat on one of the couches and waited for Rutherford to finish his battle of wits with the coffee machine.
"Rusty, we need to talk about something serious now.
The people who were coming after you took the bait about you driving to the airport. They showed up in your garage. But they passed on the opportunity to ambush you. That was the correct choice in the circumstances. They planted a tracking device on your car instead."
"But I'm not going to the airport."
Rutherford placed the mugs on the coffee table and sat on the other couch.
"What will they do when my car doesn't move?"
"I don't know. That depends on how patient they are, and on the urgency of whatever problem they're trying to solve. My guess is that it won't be much longer before they come in and get you. But we could avoid that if we can figure out what they want. I need you to focus all your attention on answering that question."
Rutherford shook his head.
"I already told you. I don't have anything that anyone could want."
"There are two possible scenarios here," Reacher said. "You have this thing and don't realize it, or they believe you have it but you don't. Option one we can work with. Option two presents more of a challenge. So here's what I want you to do. Finish your coffee, then lie back, close your eyes, and pick a day. Say, the Monday of the week before the ransomware thing began. Tell me everything you did from the moment your eyes opened in the morning until you fell asleep that night. Every single detail, however trivial. You never know what might trigger a connection."
"Okay."
Rutherford took a swig of coffee, then slipped off his shoes and swung his feet up onto the cushion.
"I'll try, but I'm not sure it'll help."
"You need to focus," Reacher said. "No distractions, so switch off your phone."
Rutherford's phone started to ring.
"Ignore it," Reacher said.
Rutherford was already pulling it out of his pocket.
He checked the screen and held it up for Reacher to see. It read, "Doorman." "I told him not to disturb you," Reacher said. "Ignore it."
"I can't. What if it's those men coming up to get me? You said they will. What if he's trying to warn me? I have to check."
Rutherford hit the speaker button and placed the phone on the table. "Mr. Rutherford, I'm sorry to disturb you, sir. I know you're not feeling well, but I have to give you a heads up. Someone's here to see you. I told her no, but she marched right by me. She's on her way up, and man, she's pissed that I tried to stop her."
Rutherford hung up, then crossed to the door and pressed his eye to the peephole.
"No one's there. Not yet. It must be one of the women from yesterday. The one who was watching the building. She must have found out which is my apartment. She's coming to get me. What are we going to do?"
"We don't have to do anything," Reacher said. "No one knows we're here."
"That's right."
Rutherford took a deep breath.
"We could lay low. Wait for her to go."
"We could. Avoid a confrontation in a confined public space, and inject some bad intelligence into their decision-making process. Two good outcomes with zero effort on our part."
"Okay, let's do that."
Rutherford turned away from the door, and a moment later, his face creased with alarm.
"Wait, what if she breaks in? She could pick the locks."
"Also good. We could join her, ask her some questions, and afterward we'd have the perfect cover. You came back from dropping some trash down the garbage chute and found an intruder in your apartment. She tried to run. She slipped, and she hit her head. Tragic, but the kind of thing that can happen when you choose a life of crime."
"We couldn't. Shh. Someone's coming."
Rutherford pressed his eye back to the peephole.
"It's... oh my goodness."
Rutherford opened the door and stepped out, still in his socks. Reacher saw a woman on the other side of the corridor. She was facing away, ready to ring Rutherford's doorbell. She had the same color hair as the Toyota driver. It was the same length. She was the same height. But her clothes were different. She was wearing a pale gray suit, and Reacher didn't recognize her face.
"Sarah!"
Rutherford held his arms out wide.
"So good to see you. What are you doing here?"
"I was worried about you."
The woman pulled Rutherford into a hug so tight it looked like she was trying to break his back.
"You stopped calling. You didn't answer your phone. I left you all kinds of messages. Then I heard what happened with your job."
"I didn't get any messages. You must have been calling my work phone. The assholes took it when they fired me. I'm sorry. I should have told you. I should have called."
"Are you okay?"
"I am. I was down for a while, but I'm doing a lot better now."
"Good.
Because there's something we need to talk about. It could be huge."
The woman's giant purse was slipping off her shoulder, and as she heaved it back into place, her head turned and she spotted Reacher standing in the doorway opposite.
"Oh, hello. You must be Mitch. I've heard a lot about you."
"Actually, no," Rutherford said. "Mitch is away. This is Jack Reacher. Reacher, this is my friend Sarah Sands, the one I told you about. Sarah was working on Cerberus with me."
Rutherford made another pot of coffee while Sands fired up her laptop and listened as Reacher ran through a summary of events since he'd arrived in town.
"I don't like this."
Sands took Rutherford's hand when he set her cup on the table and looked up at him.
"I don't like this one little bit. Someone's trying to kidnap you? That's not okay. The Bureau should be all over this. We need to keep you safe."
"That's what Reacher told the cops yesterday, but they weren't too impressed."
Rutherford sat down next to Sands.
"I'm still pretty much persona non grata around here."
"How about you, Sarah?" Reacher said. "Have you got any contacts from your Bureau days? Anyone who could light a fire under this?"
"Maybe," Sands said. "I still know some people. I could make some calls. Maybe kick up a few sparks, at least.
Have you got any idea what Rusty has that they want?
Whoever they are, we're still trying to figure that out.
Maybe I can help. I bet they want the same thing I'm here to get, the system we created, or part of it at least. Why would anyone want that piece of junk?"
Rutherford slumped back. "It didn't work."
"It didn't work the way we hoped, that's true. But that doesn't mean it was a complete failure. Something you said when the attack first happened didn't quite make sense to me, Rusty. It kept on bugging me.
So I ran a bunch of simulations, and I think I found something.
That the whole thing was a giant waste of time, Rutherford said. That we would have been better off creating a crossword puzzle app for people learning Swahili.
I can't believe you didn't see this yourself, Sans said.
There's a giant clue right there in your backup.
No, there's nothing in the backup. Nothing overwrote what was already there on whatever crappy secondhand servers I used to cobble it together.
That's exactly the point.
Oh my God.
Rutherford stood up and pressed his palm to his forehead.
Sarah, I love you.
So your system did work? Reacher took a sip of coffee. You said it didn't.
Right, Rutherford said. It didn't.
So why would anyone want it? Reacher said.
It comes down to the way ransomware works, Sans said.
Attacks don't happen all in one go. Imagine a computer network is like an enemy fortress. If you want to capture it, you don't just lob a grenade over the wall and hope the soldiers are all killed. You start by infiltrating your best guy. You smuggle him past the defenses and leave him to sneak around inside for a while. Get the lie of the land. Draw maps for when your main force arrives. Find out where all the good stuff is hidden. And see if there are any traps to avoid. In our case, for traps, read backups. Backups are kryptonite to ransomware. There's no point in locking a bunch of data if your intended victim has a clean copy. He'd just laugh in your face. And that's a big problem, because some of these groups are in the game for prestige as much as they are for cash. So if they find a backup, which are usually only connected briefly to capture a snapshot of any recent changes and then get taken offline or even off-site for safekeeping, they immediately deploy a special kind of program, a particularly sneaky kind. We call it a trident because it does three things all at once. One, it destroys all the data that's already been backed up. It's either wiped clean or replaced with porn or taunting messages or things like that. Two, it prevents any new backups getting saved. And three, it sends spoof signals to the organization's management system saying that everything is working okay. That way, it avoids alerting anyone to what's happening and adds to the blow when the main system's lockup and the ransom demand is posted. But your backups didn't get wiped, Reacher said, or overwritten with porn, did they?
No, Rutherford said. Something stopped that from happening.
But nothing new was saved. And spoof management reports did get sent. That's why I thought we'd be okay after the attack. And why I was so shocked when we weren't.
Cerberus interfered, Sans said. It broke one spike off the trident.
It's the only explanation. I ran simulations using copies of the most recent ransomware we've come across, and here's where things get interesting for the people who were chasing Rusty. In 8 out of 9 tests, not only was the existing data untouched, but a fragment of the malicious code was retained on the backup system. It was somehow caught by Cerberus when it stopped the disk from getting wiped.
Enough of a fragment to unlock the town's computers? Reacher said.
No, Sans said. It doesn't work that way. But it could reveal who's responsible.
It's like when a bank robber wears a mask, but the security cameras pick up his gang tattoos.
That must be why these men are trying to get their hands on it, Rutherford said. They must have analyzed the system maps the ransomware sent back to them. Seen something they didn't recognize, Cerberus, and figured out what it could do. Maybe put that together with the reports in the press about the old data being the only thing that survived.
You should have seen the headlines.
Rutherford's rusty ransom response was my favorite. But we have a different reason to want it. Maybe millions of different reasons. Right, Sarah?
That's why I'm here, Sans said. There's life in the guard dog yet.
It's not the product we thought it was going to be. It obviously doesn't prevent ransomware attacks from happening. But if it bulletproofs any backed-up data, that's the next best thing. A lot of organizations would pay a lot of money for that. All we need is the servers you were using. Bench tests are fine, but we need to make sure it really was our system that saved the old data, not some random malfunction. So let's go get them.
We can't get them.
Rutherford flopped back down.
When I thought the systems had failed, I threw everything in the trash.
Chapter 14. Speransky was in his study, looking through catalogs from electrical wholesalers, trying to find the closest thing to a World War II anti-aircraft searchlight, when his secure phone rang again. "We were right," the voice at the end of the line said. "It was an ambush." "How bad?" Speransky said. "Could have been worse." The main team, four people, went into the garage. They read the situation, planted a tracker on Rutherford's car, and got out unscathed. The drifter got the two men who stayed outside. "Are they dead?" "No, but they'll be out of the game for a while." He knocked them around pretty good. "And one of them got bitten by a rat before he was found. They were left in a couple of dumpsters." "Does the center know?" "Yes, but don't worry. The police didn't get involved. No members of the public saw anything. No attention was drawn. They're not pulling the plug. But they are making a change." "What kind of change?" "They're bringing someone in. Denisov. The rest of the team is stood down to surveillance only until he arrives." Speransky had never worked with Denisov, but he had heard of him. He'd started out as an interrogator. The human polygraph, he was called, due to his appearance, and his temper, his ability to loosen tongues and bowels. "I thought Denisov wasn't used in the field anymore," Speransky said. "Too many unfavorable outcomes." "No, he is," the voice said. "He's been in Chechnya for the last 5 years, broadening his repertoire, working on his self-discipline. He's rehabilitated now, back in favor with the people who count. And they're letting him loose on Rutherford. Isn't that overkill? On the drifter. The rest of the team can proceed with Rutherford as before." "Wait a minute." Sands moved over to the window, then turned back to face Rutherford. "How could you have thrown an entire server array in the trash? How many were you using?"
8.
Rutherford looked at the floor. "I guess I didn't literally throw them in the trash, but I did kind of trash them."
"What did you do to them?"
"Well, first off, the glass in the cabinet door broke when I slammed it. I did that when I realized the backup hadn't worked. Then I ripped out all the cables. I wanted to fling the whole thing in the dumpster outside, but when I tried to drag it to the door, the foot of the cabinet got wedged where part of the raised floor had come loose, so I left it. Then I went back and stuck on a post-it note saying it was for the trash."
"This was before you got fired?"
"Right. On the day of the attack."
"Was the cabinet still there the day you left?"
Rutherford shrugged.
"No idea.
I didn't go back to the equipment room after the first day. There was no point. Nothing was working. I actually thought about checking on my last day, but I was only there 10 minutes before they gave me the letter."
"No one's replaced you?"
"Not yet." Rutherford hung his head. "The job's hardly a big draw. Nothing works. The title is head of department, but there's barely a department to head. There are only 2 other staff. One's part-time, and both are furloughed until the network is fixed."
"So what are the odds that anyone saw the note saying to trash the equipment and then did anything about it?"
"Probably pretty low."
"So it might still be there?"
"It might be."
"Come on then. What are we waiting for? Let's go see."
"There's no point.
We can't get in. They made me leave my key."
"Rusty,
seriously,
think about this.
What did I spend the last decade doing? There's no such thing as a locked door as far as an FBI agent is concerned. And there'll be no one else there. The security system's down. The cabinet may as well be sitting on the sidewalk waiting for us to pick it up."
"How will we move it?"
"Between us, it'll be no problem. There must be dollies in the receiving room. How else did it get brought in when it was first delivered? I mean, how will we get it back here? It won't fit in my car. That's why I rented a minivan. But we won't bring it here. Not with people watching the building and doormen reporting your every move. We'll get a storage unit for tonight, hide it there. And tomorrow we'll rent some office space, or even a motel room. We'll need power, and space to work, and privacy." The plan was straightforward. Sans would leave first and pause in the lobby. She'd apologize to the doorman for her previous abruptness and mentioned that her friend was feeling much better. So much better that he was about to go out for a drive. Reacher and Rutherford would give him time to send his text. Then they would head to the garage. They'd take Rutherford's bug. Reacher would drive. He'd cut through the alley with the dumpsters, moving slowly enough for Rutherford to hop out, hide, and wait for Sands to collect him. Then Reacher would continue to drive around in the bug, towing the Toyota behind him as if on an invisible rope, and give Rutherford and Sands a clear shot to and from the town's IT building. No plan survives first contact with the enemy. Or in this case, Reacher's desire for contact. He started out aimlessly crisscrossing the town's streets the way a person might if he didn't realize there was a tracking device attached to his fender and was trying to spot anyone tailing him. He was uncomfortable, even with the seat racked all the way back. The pedals sticking up out of the floor were stiff and awkward. There wasn't enough room for his feet. The manual box was cranky and the frequent corners called for what seemed like constant gear changes. But most of all, Reacher didn't like having to take it on trust that he was actually being followed at all. He liked being able to sense his pursuers, to see them in his head like moving dots on a map. He felt cast adrift, less like the tow rope was invisible, more like it never existed. Reacher checked the bug's fuel gauge. It was almost dry. He was always surprised at the way civilians so often failed to refill their vehicles after driving them. What's the point in equipment that isn't maintained and ready for use? He shook his head and changed course for the truck stop he had visited earlier with Rutherford. He chose the pump nearest to the main building and approached from its right side so that no one watching from the road would get a clear view of the passenger seat. Then he locked the car and went inside. Reacher started with the clothing section. He didn't usually change twice in a day, but conditions were fluid. Operating in the dark was now in the cards, so concealment was a priority. He picked out a pair of black pants and a black hoodie, paid, and went to the restroom to change. Then he returned to the clothing area and grabbed a pack of 3 t-shirts off the shelf. He took a map, a flashlight, and an emergency gas can from the auto section, a 12-pack of bottled water from the refreshment area, filled a 20-ounce cup with a kind of extra-caffeinated coffee truckers drink when they have to drive all night, and at the register, he added 2 cigarette lighters and prepaid for plenty of gas. Back outside, Reacher stowed his new items. Everything other than the coffee and the gas can went on the floor on the passenger side of the car, along with the larger knife and the duct tape he'd bought earlier. He put the smaller knife and the lighters in his pocket and tucked the guns he'd captured into his waistband. He filled the bug's tank and topped off the can, stowed the can in the trunk. Checked the map to see if there was a way to join the route Marty had taken that morning without driving through the town again. Found one that looped around to the west. Then he folded himself back into the little car and pulled out onto the road. On the map, the road was represented by a thick black line. It suggested something wide, substantial, broadly equivalent to the one Reacher had taken on his way to the truck stop. It proved to be a poor example of the cartographer's art. On the ground, the road was little more than a track. Reacher imagined agricultural workers getting it started with horses and carts, then solidifying it with tractors and trailers, until finally the county adopted it, widened it a little, straightened it, added a meager layer of blacktop, maybe sent an occasional maintenance crew to tend the rough, pitted ribbon of scorched asphalt that twisted around sudden bends and snaked through fields and the occasional stand of trees. Reacher took it easy. He wanted to keep gear changes to a minimum, and he didn't want to end the night in a ditch. Eventually, the track dumped him out onto the route Marty had used south of the town. The light was fading fast, and the traffic, which had been thin earlier in the day, was now non-existent. Reacher checked his mirror every few seconds. There was no sign of a car behind him, no glinting of the setting sun on a windshield, no trace of headlights. Reacher came to a long straight section, so he pushed the gas pedal all the way down to the floor. The engine rattled and growled behind him. The steering wheel twitched and throbbed. He kept his speed up for as long as he dared and hit the brakes going into the next bend. He was a fraction late, The car pitched and squirmed. Its narrow tires squealed. He emerged into the next straight, half on the wrong side of the road, corrected course, and slowed to walking speed. He checked his mirror. There was no sign of a car behind him. He passed the spot where Marty had stopped, checked his mirror. There was no sign of a car. He saw the entrance to the field he had cut across. There was no sign of a car. He accelerated under a bridge that had once been used to carry water for the crops. No sign of a car. Then the bug's feeble beams picked out the tall shape of the Studebaker sign. Reacher eased off the gas. He wanted his pursuers to be clear what he was doing, assuming anyone was pursuing him at all. Reacher steered the bug through the gap between the old showroom and the abandoned gas station kiosk. He stopped the car at a careless angle and climbed out, leaving his door open. He checked the kiosk to make sure Marty wasn't still shackled to the water pipe, then fetched the gas can from the trunk and took the water bottles, the t-shirts, and the flashlight from the passenger's footwell. He left the passenger's door open and made his way to the section of hoarding at the back of the showroom where he had seen the woman and one of the guys emerge when they fled. He tugged at the plywood. It was loose at one side, so he enlarged the gap and squeezed through. He stepped into a large space with an arc of tall windows in place of a front wall. They were all boarded up. A range of tall display cases covered one side. The glass was broken and the shelves were bare. Reacher swept the flashlight beam around slowly and picked up a line of footprints in the dust on the floor. He followed them to a door at the far side of the showroom. It led to a flight of wooden steps. They'd seen better days, that was for sure. Their paint had long since worn away. There were cracks in their surface. The handrail sagged when Reacher touched it. He thought twice about going up. What he had in mind could be accomplished from the ground, given sufficient cover. But he was in the mood for something theatrical, not functional. Reacher kept to the side nearer the wall, where the steps should be at their strongest. He took them slowly, testing each one carefully before committing his weight. He crept his way to the top, which gave access to a hatch leading to the roof. He heaved the water bottles up and through, then the gas can. Then he climbed out after them. The surface was flat. It had once been covered with some kind of silver coating, to make it waterproof and to protect the building from the worst of the sun's heat. Now the surface was dull and peeling. It was covered with leaves and twigs and assorted pieces of trash that the wind had somehow deposited there. Much of it had blown against the base of the wall that enclosed the whole space. It was 3 feet tall, like the rampart on a miniature castle, Reacher thought, which was just how he was planning to use it. He crossed to the rear corner at the side of the building next to the kiosk and separated 6 bottles of water from the pack. He emptied them, then half-filled them with gas. He cut the t-shirts into strips and fed them into the bottles, leaving plenty hanging over their necks. Then he lined the bottles up at the base of the wall and took one of the lighters out of his pocket. Reacher's plan was only missing one component, a target. He sat and waited, and no car appeared in the gap below. He began to worry that he was on a wild goose chase, and that he was the goose. He crossed to the stem of the vertical sign and looked for movement on the road. There was none. Then he caught a glimmer of light, a quarter of a mile away. He thought, but he wasn't sure. He kept watching, willing it to reappear, and he picked up the sound of a vehicle. It was coming from the other direction, a panel van. It was bouncing and swaying along the road, moving fast. Maybe a plumber, anxious to get home after a long day, or an electrician, or a drunk. The van slowed a little and its lights picked out a familiar shape hunkered down beneath the water bridge, the blue Toyota. It had followed him, but it wasn't looking to engage, just to observe, to note where he went, close enough to see if he switched cars or got a ride with someone else, too far away for Reacher to incinerate. He kept watching, willing it to change tack, to approach. Another 5 minutes passed. There was no movement. Then Reacher's phone buzzed. It was another text, also from Rutherford. It said the same thing as the first. In. Safe. That meant Reacher could head back, too. He could let the Toyota follow. Creeping along behind him on its electronic tether, the guys in it could file an innocuous report, inform their bosses about every detail of Reacher's evening. But Reacher didn't like that idea. When he sent a message, he liked it to be clear and unambiguous. Someone had sent six guys after him. It would be wrong to let the day end with only two of them in the hospital. Reacher put the lighter back in his pocket and emptied the gas out of the bottles. He eased his way back down the steps to the showroom and crossed to a door in the center of the back wall. It led to a corridor with another door at the far end, one door on the left, and two evenly spaced on the right. The one on the left opened into a double office. Based on the age of the building, Reacher guessed the outer part would have been for a secretary and the larger inner room for a manager, or the owner of the franchise. Both offices were empty. The first door on the right led to a small kitchen. There were no appliances or utensils, just a formica countertop with enough space for preparing drinks or light snacks. Next up was a pair of bathrooms. There was a cleaning closet tucked in between them. A broom had been left behind, and a mop, and a bucket, a roll of towels, a bottle of bleach, and some floor polish. Reacher moved on to the door at the end of the corridor. It led to the final section of the building. A car-sized space with a roll-up door to the side, drain holes in the floor, but no vehicle lift and no room for serious tools. Some kind of valet bay, Reacher thought, where cars had been detailed before going on display, or got ready for collection. There was a metal cabinet against the far wall. Reacher wrestled it open and found a tub of hand cleaner, long dried up, a tin of wax, some chalky paste for brightening up white wall tires, a bottle of detergent, a tube of tar remover, and a bottle of glass cleaner. Reacher opened it, sniffed the contents, nodded to himself, and doubled back to the cleaning closet to collect the bleach. He figured it was time to find out how well he remembered his high school chemistry. Reacher squeezed out through the gap in the plywood hoarding and made his way back to the bug, to the rear. He felt around the inside of the fender until he found the tracking device. He detached it and placed it on the ground directly below the car. He took a last swig of coffee, removed the lid, emptied the dregs, tied the one remaining t-shirt around his head so that it covered his mouth and nose. Then, working at arm's length, which was farther for Reacher than most people, he poured bleach into the coffee cup until it was half full. He topped it off with glass cleaner, replaced the lid, closed the passenger's door, wound down the driver's window, then climbed into the car and started the engine. He held the cup in his left hand so that he could shift and set off slowly back to the road. He drove with no lights, as smoothly as he could manage, in the direction of the town.